Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
You gonna have any unscripted, commentary on the music today, Bill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I got it all loaded up.
We had some open mic moments last week with Bill.
Yeah.
I hate that song. I was like, yeah. Oh, wow, really? Now everyone knows. So
I'm very transparent.
Yeah, we are now. Although you are wearing pants, so that's good. We like that. So we have Officer Joe with us.
Was that an option?
That's why Bill's wearing pants. He's here to make sure Bill keeps the pants on. We have Officer Joe with us and Kathy.
Yes.
Because?
Let's eradicate before we recreate.
Right. We're talking about our favorite topic. But it's actually another iteration of our favorite topic. So not just the marijuana thing, not just the health effects, all that, which Lord knows we've got plenty of data for you on that. So if, in fact, you have not plugged in or you're thinking you're pretty smart on this topic, you should go to wethepeopleradio.us, click on the tab marked pot, fairly straightforward, up at the top of the page. All the shows are on there. And for those of you who don't know our work, our body of work, there's Bill's first one. Phone buzzing.
At least my ringer was off.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, yeah. So that's only a half of one. That's not a whole. It's not a whole point. Whole point off.
Everybody wants to talk to me.
That's right. Super popular. Kathy just called you just to see if your phone was on.
I wanted to see if you really had pants on or not.
Well, there was that. That's why the phone was on the desk, right? No pockets. Monty's like, I'm not going to be able to do this show as a federal prosecutor, for God's sake. I can't be affiliated with people like this. Hey, you know what? Serious topic with liberal humor, right? Not a liberal topic, just a liberal humor. So we kind of something for everybody.
Yeah.
But at wethepeopleradio.us, the archives are always up after the program. We leave them up there. They date back to October of 2010, I think, on a multitude of topics. They're free to listen to, free to download. We don't care what you do with them. We're not going to come after you like the guy that constantly sends me emails from some lawyer that says, you know, we're going to fine you because you used something off our Google search or whatever, idiots. But you can use our material however you like, and please go and educate people with it. There's a ton of information on there. And today, there's a ton of information on our guest, Monty Stiles. He has a wonderful bio on there for you with all of his detail, because I like to include that, not just because, oh, we have somebody on here who's really smart, but we have somebody on here who's really credible. So if we're going to talk about topics, so much of what we hear in our media on pretty much every level is opinion. And our opinion is, like, not worth that much, you know, opinions. But facts are kind of great, and we're big fans of that. We should change the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting back to facts.
We muddy the waters with facts.
Like the olden days, right, when we had facts.
Walter Cronkite.
Right? If you found out Walter Cronkite was a liar, wouldn't you be crushed?
Oh, I would totally be
like,
crushed.
Wait, what? My whole life's a lie.
We're dating ourselves, too, you know.
I liked it. It was fun. Well, it's kind of like, you know, hey, 30 years ago, and you think it's the 70s, right? But it's really the 90s, and yeah, it's like, wow, how old am I? So Monty served 30 years in law enforcement as a federal drug prosecutor. See, so the hammer's going to fall here pretty quick. All this buffoonery is going to end. unless, of course, Monty was starved for buffoonery. And after seeing the darkest aspects of the human condition, a passion for nature photography gave him the opportunity to rediscover everything that is wonderful in life. The fact that there were no humans, just animals, and he was looking at them through a lens, I'm sure didn't hurt. A world full of amazing people, beautiful landscapes, fascinating creatures, and boundless opportunities and adventures. And then I'll just add without handcuffs. During this time, he spoke to hundreds of groups on a variety of topics involving the law as well as the consequences of crime, which as a federal prosecutor, I'm sure he is well-versed. I have, he says, I now have the opportunity to speak and train all around the country and especially enjoy working with young people. And does a workshops, keynote addresses with law enforcement, drug education topics, and he also does presentations and things on fun things like the joy of photography, taking better pictures, and photo excursions. So that sounds kind of fun, actually. We should have made this a field trip radio program.
Only if I can bring my trailer.
So it's all upside for you, Monty. But honestly, Officer Joe's job was to go find us somebody to talk about hemp, because that isn't really something we've talked about it a little bit, but it's becoming kind of popular in some of our, you know, places that say have not legalized commercial growing, but now they're like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to grow hemp because hemp is so harmless and friendly and not marijuana-y. Yeah,
it worked out well for the guys up in Oregon.
Yeah, and that didn't work. That didn't pencil. But no. So you drew the short straw and became hemp guy.
From a peace officer status, Monty will know this, that we consider hemp to be marijuana light, less than 3% THC content, as tested by our very safe state labs.
Same ones who actually did discover that they're like a monster amount of chemicals on all of it.
Every week, almost every day now, I'm getting DCC recalls on California marijuana products. And as you know, and our audience will know.
Department of Cannabis Control? I was like, DCC, what the heck's a DCC? All right.
Department of Cannabis Control. And as you know, Siskiyou County just established another state of emergency, but this one's even a little bit more dire in that their peace officers, firefighters, and first responders going into the grows are now coming down with evil, wicked, mean, and nasty medical issues and having to be hospitalized and then rehospitalized for these same issues for responding into the grows because of the toxic chemicals in there. And we know now definitively from loads coming out of those grows that they are going into legal dispensaries. So these legal dispensaries are buying these illegal products, which we knew all along was going on. And so people are now consuming pesticides. And you can go on YouTube on any given day and just run what am I smoking, and you'll see from the marijuana community that they're up in arms because of all the stuff that's coming into the legal dispensaries now.
Terrific.
But not up in arms enough to not get it from the illegal.
Yeah, right.
Those.
Right. We'll still buy it.
So kind of only up in one arm?
Yeah. Half an arm.
Not both.
So hemp is interesting, and Monty will go into this, and I'm going to let him speak here in just a sec. Hemp's interesting because the hemp plant itself is indistinguishable from marijuana. So if you're growing hemp, the male hemp plant, which marijuana growers do not want to have in their fields because it will sterilize their fields. So if you're growing hemp, what we have found is that they will try to grow hemp one row on the outside, and they'll grow marijuana on the inside because it's indistinguishable. And in this county, Shasta County, we looked at hemp seriously, and they gave it a shot. They tried it. There wasn't enough commercial benefit for it, and the sheriff, rightfully so, came in and said, hey, I can't distinguish the difference. I don't have enough personnel to do that. Detectors are $25,000 each. I have to have two of them to confirm results, and even then, we're not really sure what's being grown. And he said it's just a ruse for the marijuana businesses to be able to overwhelm law enforcement and grow more marijuana within the county, trying to say, oh, it's hemp, it's legal, and then grow it everywhere. It uses the same amount of water. Again, it's marijuana light. It uses the same amount of water. It uses the same amount of chemicals. And the interesting thing about the marijuana plant itself is it's a vacuum. It's a vacuum to the earth. So any heavy metals that are in the earth, they actually use it in environmental remediation.
Yeah, Chernobyl stuff.
Right.
They used marijuana plants.
Yeah.
And all the heavy metals out of the ground.
Yeah. So, you know, is that something you really want to be smoking? Is that something we want to be supporting? And then as everyone sitting here and Monty will tell us,
Let's let Monty tell us.
Yeah, let's let Monty. Monty, I'm going to shut up, and it's time to hear
Monty,
from you.
Monty, you tell us.
Yeah, you tell us.
No, you tell us.
Officer Joey, I don't need to be on. You know all this stuff. You've been talking about it forever. You and others in your area, county, the epicenter of a lot of this chaos, have been at the forefront of fighting the battle. You have great law enforcement people. You've used great strategies to fight but you're surrounded, you're outmanned, outgunned, outfinanced, but you continue to fight. I admire that. It's awesome. It needs to continue. You are a shining beacon of what should be done. Unfortunately, you are outnumbered right now. Examples, experiences that people like you have had in California and elsewhere has given we Idahoans the tools, the information necessary to fight back before it happens to us. Those experiences have been the reason Idaho has never passed any of this nonsense, because we have learned from the experiences of other states that have experimented with disastrous liberal drug policies and laws that have created economic, medical, political, legal chaos. And so thank you for the work you're doing. I know your show's been on, what, Aaron, Bill, 10, 15 years so far?
Yeah.
Yeah. The list of shows you've done for 15 years is amazing. Yeah. It is amazing to see.
Kind of a crazy train, huh? You know,
it is.
China and
topics.
You know, all sorts of stuff.
All of those things. But just looking at the people that are in law enforcement and talked on this and related topics, the list of guests is so impressive. I said to Joe, why in the world are you calling me? You've had Bertha Madras, Dave Evans, Laura Steck, all of these people on over the years. And it's just amazing what you're doing. Thank you for your continued work to educate people on these important topics.
Well, from the prosecutor side, like, I don't know, should we, like, march through your career from the beginning, right? We don't want to start with the photography. I guess talking about photography on radio probably is a little frustrating as well. Those pictures are beautiful. Can everyone see them? Oh, yeah, you can. But on your website, they are terrific, and we've linked, you know, just as an aside, we've linked your website and all that, so really they can go look at the pictures, and they are really, really good. But when you were a prosecutor, where were you? I forget. Geographically?
Well, I was born and raised in Idaho. After living different places and going to college and law school, I came back to Boise and started my legal career in the Ada County Prosecutor's Office. I was a deputy prosecutor a long time ago. And it was an amazing experience. I'd lived this great life growing up in Emmett. Wonderful family, grandparents, all kinds of people that loved me, helped raise me when I was a kid. And so I came back to raise a family here. And Ada County Prosecutor's Office, I was immediately thrown into a world that was unlike anything I had experienced before, because all of a sudden I'm exposed to every bad thing that happens. As a new deputy prosecutor, typically aren't given homicide cases. We had kind of simple cases, but within the first 3 weeks of being at the prosecutor's office, I was at my first homicide scene.
Wow.
I was at the homicide scene. I talked to the person who killed another person in the state prison. I went to the autopsy, sat there, stood there by the table as the autopsy was performed, and that introduced me to a world that most people do not understand unless they are in it themselves, or they're able to experience it kind of in cases, professions like mine, other law enforcement people. You start to see the grim realities of people's bad choices and how those choices impact them, their victims, and the community as a whole. And it was a very eye-opening experience. And I loved it from the beginning, but it was, you saw everything that the worst parts of human nature and the consequences of bad choices.
Monty, I would love to know about your the experiences as a federal prosecutor, and could you take a case for us and perhaps do a forensic analysis so that we, as the listening audience, can understand how do you actually get it? You know, does it come in from a law enforcement agency? What kind of investigation do you have to do? And then what happens from beginning to end to prosecution?
Yeah, that's a good question. Of course, a lot of crimes come to a prosecutor's attention. It's a reactive situation. A crime's committed, an investigation's done, reports are created, they're brought to the prosecutor's office, who decides what to do with the information, seeking a complaint or a warrant or a search warrant or an indictment. So in the beginning, a lot of cases just come in. There's a burglary, the reports come in. But in the drug world, and I spent a couple of years doing all the child abuse cases, juvenile delinquency cases, all of those kind of things, mental health cases. But I quickly realized that most of the people in the criminal justice system were there as a result of an underlying substance abuse problem. Hmm. They either did dumb things while under the influence of various drugs, both legal and illegal, or as a result of being in the drug world, they committed crimes to support their habit, sell drugs themselves, do all kinds of terrible things. And it really became obvious to me early in my career that the criminal justice system seemed like this giant banyan tree that you see in exotic places, with a huge trunk and leaves. And after a while, I started to view myself as this little guy on a stepladder at the end of this banyan tree, clipping off a few leaves at a time. But after seeing and hearing defendants and listening to what they did and why they did it, it became obvious that the roots of this tree were substance abuse. And if we wanted to make a real difference, if I wanted to make a real difference, my time would best be served in attacking the roots, which was substance abuse. Because if we could help people make better choices, and they do not do these things, dumb things, because their judgment is impaired, and that's really the source of a lot of bad decisions. Their judgment's impaired, so they do things that hurt themselves and they hurt others. And so I started doing drug cases very early on. And when we started doing drug cases, a lot of times those are reactive. Somebody gets stopped in a car and they've got a pound of cocaine. So there's a case. But a lot of drug cases, especially the more important ones, are done in a proactive manner. You find a witness, you find an informant, you learn about a particular person, more importantly, an organization, a group of people that are doing a lot of bad things, and you start your investigation. So you might have an informant that starts providing information. Along with the informant, you do surveillance, you do other kinds of investigative techniques. A lot of times an officer is introduced in an undercover capacity, so that they're in portraying themselves as one of the drug users, drug dealers. You infiltrate that way, and you gather information. And sometimes the information gathered in a few days, a few weeks. In some of our cases, especially in the federal system, there were cases that were involved years of investigation. One in particular started in Sun Valley Ski Resort area in Idaho. And over the next several years, that took us to Hong Kong 3 times, Thailand 2 times, Fiji.
Wow.
At the end, we seized, $28 million of assets in Europe, all over the United States, property in Fiji, Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong. And these were all Thai marijuana smugglers who started out as surfer dudes in Southern California, in their teenage years and became major marijuana smugglers with boatloads of Thai weed. It's fascinating. So
makes the $50,000 we.
Question.
It makes the $50,000 we just seized in Happy Valley last week on a marijuana grow, like chump change compared to what you have. I think Aaron's going to do something here. Aaron, you going to do something for us?
Oh, we're going to take a break. How are we doing? Yeah, I just changed. All right. I just changed the music because I had a thought. So Bill's trying to rush me. I have a lot of supervision here, Monty. Just so you know, and I just want you to know that just temperamentally, I'm not a fan of supervision. Actually, that's just not my jam. so we're not gonna have any crimes committed here. But if the supervision continues, there may be some dead air. Oh, my God. We'll be right back. Our guest is Monty Stiles, and you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
.us.
You're fired, Bill.
No.
Yeah.
Don't.
Fired. Perfect lead in, because after they do that, then they meet Monty.
A lot of them did. I met a lot of them, and it was fascinating to investigate these cases, because you would first, in the federal system, the penalties are all based on quantity, and we didn't have time for low-level drug traffickers. If it didn't meet a certain threshold, we didn't pay any attention to it. So we would do these investigations on these major traffickers and organizations. And for a long time, we would gather information about them, watch what they're doing, sometimes do wiretaps, all of these, and learn about how they operated, what they did, how they did it, why they did it, all those things. But ultimately, in the federal system, because the penalties are so heavy, I interviewed most of the defendants I ever prosecuted, because virtually all of them cooperated in the end. So I had this unique situation where I know a lot about people, but ultimately hear it from their own lips, because they would have to come in and there'd be a DEA agent and myself and some others there, and the defendant sitting across the conference table with in handcuffs in an orange jumpsuit and telling us their whole life. And this is what I did. This is how I did it. This is who I did it with. This is where the money went. All of that. And so I had very unique perspective on criminals, why they do these things, how they do them. And that's been very helpful as I segued into the drug prevention world, because that criminal element that continues to exist, especially in this world where we've normalized a lot of drug use that's allowed the black market to thrive. They thrive in a world of legalization and normalization. It's helped me understand how they continue to work to the detriment of kids, families, communities, states, nation.
Monty, here on the West Coast, we find that Jalisco New Generation and the Sinaloa cartels are predominantly involved in marijuana with the Hmong, and then finally the Chinese are moving in and taking over, and that money's going back to New York. In your federal world, you were able to chase that money overseas. Is that correct?
A lot of the money, well, back in the day, our Sun Valley smuggling case, a lot of the money went overseas. It was hidden. and this happens a lot in huge cases. The money's held in offshore banks, can be European banks, could be Caribbean banks, could be Hong Kong. That money goes in cash to places where it can be hidden, kept in numbered accounts. No one knows where it went. It's hard to trace.
Do you have to banks?
Currency. Well, yeah. Ultimately, the goal in any big drug conspiracy investigation is to stop the criminal activity, to seize the drugs, stop the defendants who are doing it, and take away their assets. We learned a long time ago that it does very little good to stop one drug trafficker, put him in jail, because there's too many people to take their place. If you're going to be effective against organized crime, you have to go after organizations. And when you go after organizations, you have to take out the people at the top, as high up as you can, and you have to take away their assets, because their assets are what gives them the power and influence to commit these crimes. So when I worked with the federal government for 26 years, our task force, not only did we have DEA, FBI, U.S. Marshals, one of our key elements was the IRS. One of my best dope cops was an IRS agent because he knew dope and he knew money. And he could trace the money and we could find it, whether it flowed into bank accounts or into real property, homes, boats, cars, planes, whatever it was. And we would take those away through asset forfeiture. And that's very, very, very important. You have to take away the purpose of their criminal activity, which is to make money. You follow the money.
So do you think that...
And oftentimes...
So do you think we're starting to see a bigger influence when we talk about following the money on our voting and money being pushed back on their candidates? And is there a direct...
Oh, goodness. I could talk for hours about that. The influence of pot money in politics is frightening. These people, the drug traffickers themselves, have so much money. I mean, dope equals money. And so a lot of dope means a lot of money. And that money is used to do a lot of things. And one of it is to influence people who make policies and laws and voters. As drugs have been legalized in various states, the so-called legit pot industry, as it's grown in wealth and power, has used that to lobby, to fund voter initiatives in which voters are overwhelmed with propaganda because our side, the drug prevention side, the law enforcement side, we don't have any money to counter multi-million dollar campaigns that tell people, that tell voters that this is a great idea, that it's all going to be rainbows and unicorns if we just legalize pot. And so state after state falls to this nonsense. And as it does, the pot industry grows stronger with more wealth. They use that to fund more campaigns, to push further for legalization, greater legalization, legalization of other drugs. And they do a lot of lobbying, and they do a lot of donations. And that has an impact on government.
So I'm going to wheel you back a little bit, because we do want to touch on hemp too. But from what I have researched, a lot of the like the Delta 8 and the Delta 10, because they don't fall in quite the same category as Delta 9, because it's supposedly less THC. But what we're seeing is their derivatives being sold everywhere because there are no controls on that. So we're seeing these type of derivatives popping up in gas stations and vape shops and all easily accessible to our youth.
Yeah, you're exactly right. we opened up a Pandora's box years ago. It started in some respects with farm organization demanding that they be able to grow this crop called hemp, which was it was a Trojan horse from the very beginning. That started a mess. One of the biggest tragedies in American drug policy was the passage of the Farm Bill, which legalized the growing of hemp with less than 0.3% THC. There is no way to regulate that. There is no way. It is an uncontrolled industry that is sold everywhere. As predicted, the hemp industry has produced all of these variations of THC that weren't even known about in the beginning, and they show up in all kinds of products, and it's out of control. And I often tell people that even in states where they claim to regulate this stuff, it's like having one park ranger for the entire Yellowstone National Park. It is not enough. It is no regulation. It's the perception or the deception of regulation that does not happen. And thankfully, this mess is finally getting the attention of people in Washington and other states where they're saying, we can't have this happening anymore. It's out of control. And that's all a product of buying into the original story that this wasn't a big deal, that it would be okay, that we could control it, we could regulate it. It was never going to happen.
Well,
it is now so out of control and largely facilitated by criminalizations, not just so-called legit or supposedly regulated by states.
Well, I hear from people all the time that if we... and I guess maybe we should do this on the backside of the break, but, you know, time to mull it over, I suppose. You know, there is always this, I don't know, drumbeat that the war on drugs was a failure, that if we just legalized everything, so there's that, so definitely not going to drag you down that rabbit hole. But if there was no prosecution of marijuana, there was no, you know, you could only have 12 plants, you can, you know, if there wasn't all this stuff and you could sell it, it would be, you know, legal and it would be so much less money and all of that. And that we have not seen that happen. And I guess I'm curious to know, when this was all being proposed, what were people in your kind of position, right? You're one facet of it, but the law enforcement, the prosecutors, all that. I'm curious what the lobbying effort was and I guess what you guys anticipated, and then what was the change in crime from like before to after, and where's the trajectory now, even though you're out of that industry? So you have 2 minutes to mull that over, Mounty. You can play the Jeopardy music for yourself or listen to the commercial. Either way, we will come back with our guest, Mounty Stiles, to unravel that whole sweater I just built for you. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at, are you ready, Bill?
I'm ready.
We the People Radio.
.us.
That's called a pregnant pause.
Almost got fired again.
When all of a sudden this policeman caught me unaware. He said, is your name Pedro? I said, yeah, I guess so. He said, then come with me, because you're the man we've been looking for. I said, hey, man, I've been framed. Hey, no, really, man, I was framed. I never do nothing wrong, man. But every time I get the plane, I've been framed.
Gonna have a little fun, gonna get
we forgot to warn you that all the music is inappropriate and sort of silly. But I'm saving Cameron's favorite song for next hour.
I love it.
And he knows exactly what I'm talking about. And I'll let you know ahead of time, Monty, but then you're going to get a little eye into old Officer Joe there and his musical situation here. So, okay, from your vantage point, because we know what we saw in our communities. We see people, you know, just basically sprawled all over the place like boneless chickens, you know, all over the grass, all over the streets, all over everywhere, that are all high or whatever they are. And it really, really took off after this whole legalization here. But you're in a different state. You had a different vantage point. What did you think was going to happen, and then what did you see?
Well, as the head of the Federal Drug Task Force, when all of this started happening, I was first shocked that any state would be suckered into the idea that the pot legalizers promoted, which was, if we legalize, it will take it away from kids. They won't have access to it because it'll all be regulated.
Right.
And it will stop organized crime. It will do away with drug dealers. And I thought, no, that's too dumb for anybody to buy into.
Certainly no one would fall for that.
That's too dumb. And over the years, as state after state has fallen for this thing, it was important for me and others to figure out why. And I'll tell you exactly why. It's because the pot lobbyists, the pot industry, the pot promoters had money. It started with pro-pot billionaires that invested millions and millions into every state campaign, as these pot lobbying organizations grew in power and strength, they started funding these state-run campaigns. And as then the so-called legit pot industry grew in power and wealth, they began funding these campaigns that are overwhelmingly in favor of lies that are told to the public, with very little response on the other side. Government has done a terrible job of educating people about the consequences of legalization.
Reinforce what you're saying, Trump just attended a fundraising dinner in New Jersey that was $1 million a plate, and guess who was sponsoring it? It was the pot industry, and he is considering lowering it from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3. So they're hard at work.
Yeah, I know.
Spending money.
So just to give you an idea, I've looked at every state. For example, the western states. Of the western states, and I think there was 7 or 8 that I looked at, just looking at the public records of funding, the pot industry, pot lobbying organizations, have invested since 1996 when California went down, have invested $100 million to convince voters to legalize pot in 8 western states. $100 million. You think about a state like Idaho. If they come in and they put in $1 million or $2, how much money do you think we could raise to fight that? There's no drug education organizations, there's no state agency that can come up with $1 million to counter a campaign like that. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, in Idaho, more than a decade ago, we had legislative leaders, we had a governor who got dialed in on this issue. They were educated, and when this first hit, they said, no, it's not going to happen here. Not happening here. California can do whatever they want. Oregon can go nuts. Washington could go nuts. Colorado can do stupid things. We are not doing that here. And we have more than a decade of our leaders and other groups fighting this so that kind of influence has never taken hold. I don't know why other states didn't do it the same way, but they have not. We have great leadership here. They know the facts, and when somebody comes in and says, oh, this is going to cause this to happen, this is going to have this benefit, they say, baloney, we know better, not happening here. And as a result, the people on the pot side view Idaho as the most most antagonistic of all states towards legalization. We're the most hostile state in America for legalization. And that's because people paid attention from the very beginning. We learned from the mistakes of others. We saw that the promises of the pot world were untrue. They were lies. They were always lies. And we made decisions and policies and laws that were consistent with the facts, not the lies.
And Monty, I invite all of the listeners to look at one of the documentaries out of Idaho called Smokescreen. It's excellent. And
It's on our site.
It's on our page. Okay, great.
Yeah, that's
Chronic
good.
Chronic State is the one we created. It was the first
one. Oh, yeah.
One.
Remember that
and
one?
Chronic State, too. Yeah. Yep.
That was good, too. Yeah.
It was excellent. And yep. it was an example of the kind of things we were doing to educate our governmental leaders and our public so they wouldn't be persuaded to join this nonsense. And thank goodness it's continued. We just have great people here. And well, I feel bad. We look at what's going on in other places and you think the chaos that's been created, for what end? What benefit has this done to any child, any family, any community? You guys are a prime example of what's happening to your beautiful forests and public lands and
private land. Our biggest problem is private property these days. Because see, once they legalize it, you're looking at a $500 fine. Well, if you can make millions, billions, do the math. Why wouldn't you risk the big $500 compliance fine? It's not that big a deal.
Exactly. So here's something from the criminal investigation world. This is what I know.
Okay.
The pot legalization allowed criminal organizations to literally hide in plain sight. There's so much going on, you can't distinguish the good or the bad guys. They hide in plain sight. They are emboldened by legalization. It allows them to commit more crimes and hurt more people. And my goal as a prosecutor never was just to put people in jail. My goal was to get drugs out of the communities. And I wanted people to not use drugs, to make good choices. Wasn't any fun putting people in jail. I'd much rather people make good choices, live good lives, and not hurt people. But they do. And so they have to be stopped. And when they're not stopped, they do it more. And that's what's happening in places like your beautiful state.
So the idea that, federally, if we just walked away from it and just opened the doors, that would free up law enforcement to work. See, this, I hear this all the time.
Yeah.
They would be able to work on
real
crimes. What? You've heard that too? Oh my God, it's not just me. Yeah, you'd be able to work on
real
crimes.
But drugs are not real crimes.
Yeah. So when you get back to the people laying in the street, the cartels, the criminal organizations that deal in pot, are the same people that sell fentanyl.
Yep.
The legalization of pot have allowed them to grow their pot industry, their pot business, which allows them to bring in more fentanyl. In fact, if anything, one weird thing happened years ago when the cartels found themselves in competition with states who are suddenly becoming drug dealers themselves, allowing the sale and then collecting the drug proceeds in the form of taxes. The cartels found themselves competing with states. Guess what they did? They turned their attention to fentanyl. They actually decided that well, if the state's going to compete with us in marijuana, we're going to come into these other things. It increased the amount of fentanyl coming in. And then, ironically, later, the cartels were able to come back into the marijuana world and flourish in all of those worlds. So our states have increased fentanyl problems simply because we've allowed these cartels to get out of control. And it's got to stop.
From a prosecutor...
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, as a prosecutor, you know, you started with, you prosecuted all these cases, and when you sort of drilled down on them, there was an underlying drug problem. Go back to that for us just for a minute, and how, because we were told as kids, you know, in the 60s or whatever, yes, we're old, that marijuana was a gateway drug. And, of course, our parents didn't know anything, so we all laughed, but we weren't really smoking pot for the most part because it wasn't really available. And so we didn't know, but we figured our parents didn't know anything because we didn't know anything. But what is the current, you know, that you've seen in the last, like with your career, is that the gateway drug or do they start with other stuff? Because I can't imagine you'd, like, the first thing you would ever try is, like, stick a needle in your arm or something bizarre like that.
Yeah. Yeah, gateway drug is a term that's used sometimes not correctly. Anything can be a gateway to further drug use. Alcohol, tobacco, vaping, certainly marijuana. The gateway theory is that if you start down one road, it's going to lead to other behavior. The best way to explain it, I mean, watch this with thousands of people, is that when you start to consume something that is addictive or impairs your judgment, it leads to other things. Because impaired judgment leads to poor choices. A common thing in the world of kids, they're around kids that smoke weed. So they smoke a little bit of weed. It doesn't make them crazy. They're not addicted. But they're around people that also have access to other drugs often. And so when you're high and you feel bulletproof and immortal and someone hands you a pill or some powder or something else and they say, hey, this is even better, your brain's not working. People that are impaired do dumb things. They drive. They commit theft. They do other bad things. It leads to bad choices. And bad choices are the fundamental thing that I worry the most about. That's why I got into drug prevention, drug education, which I'm very, very passionate about. Because if we don't help our youth make good choices, and by doing that, we have to model good choices ourselves. If we don't start to do more in that area, where nothing we do, no law, no policy we ever make will make a difference, because it boils down to helping people make good choices for their own lives and everyone around them.
But if we can't...
I love drug education.
Yeah, but we need to get the adults and the leaders in our community to understand that, and that's where the drug money stops us, because we cannot get the people that have the power to make those decisions to see that we need to be making better choices for our youth. We need to be setting that example and not just having our hand out for the dollars.
Yeah. If the kids in your community are being told by their leaders that drugs are not harmful, in fact, there may be even medicine, and even if they're not either one of those, we can make money by doing it. What chance do our kids have?
Let's put a store on every corner so that we can tell everybody that it's perfectly safe and, well, it's legal. Mm,
it's legal.
It's legal, so what's the problem?
And our kids deserve better. Our kids deserve better. And frankly, if you have politicians making choices, money over kids and money over families, they need to be exposed. And that's one of the brilliant things that our leaders here, and I don't know, do, is when somebody comes up with a dumb idea, and they want to do something that's counterproductive to what we've prevented for more than a decade, they get exposed.
Nice.
Basically, hey.
We have to take a really quick break, Monty, and then we're going to come back because you're a hostage for the second hour. Spoiler alert. You're listening to We the People. We're coming back with Monty Stiles on the back of this. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's all going to pot, whether we like it or not. The best I can tell, the world's gone to hell, and we're all gonna miss it a lot. All the whiskey in Lynchburg, Tennessee, just couldn't hit the spot. Got $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend. It's all going to pot. $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend, because it's all going to pot.